welcome to episode 5 of the Wild Edge podcast with me, Ollie France. Thank you for joining us. It's great to have you here, and I am very excited to share this upcoming conversation with you. And this is something a little different. So far on this podcast, I've spoken to adventurers, explorers, people pushing the limits of human potential, human performance. And today's guest, he certainly fits into that category. Today, I will be speaking with Richard Browning. He is the founder of Gravity Industries. He's a former Royal Marine Reserve. He's an ultra runner. But this new project, Gravity Industries, he is using this to reimagine human flight. Richard is the inventor of a jet suit. And if you haven't seen this thing already, when you finish the episode, I'm not going to tell you to tune off just yet, but you need to check this out. It is insane what he has produced, this ergonomic, fast-flying jet suit, which he has used to climb mountains, to board ships. He's worked with some of the biggest names in adventure, Bear Grylls and co. And just a couple of weeks before our conversation, he was out with the founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, giving a private show. So he's very much in demand. His performances with his jet suit have taken him all around the world, and he's also now working with the likes of Special Forces on and Mountain Rescue with this really unique product. So I was very lucky, very grateful to get a small slice of Richard's time for him to sit down with me and share his story. So thank you, Richard. And I'm very privileged to be able to bring this to you today. Okay, I want to say a big thank you to everybody who's been in touch over the last couple of weeks. We've had some great responses to recent guests, Chaz Powell and Lucy Shepherd, who have shared their stories on world first expeditions that they have undertaken. So thanks for everyone getting in touch. If you are enjoying the podcast, I'm going to keep saying it, I'd love for you to subscribe. And please, please keep on sharing this podcast around. Share it with friends, anybody you think will get value out of these conversations. I really, really appreciate it. I'm also really eager to hear any suggestions you may have. Who do you want to hear from on this podcast? I've got some exciting guests coming up, but it's always great to know what stories are out there, who I could speak to, and listen, I want to set a high bar. I want people who are really pushing the limits. And so if you can think of somebody, if there's a story out there that you'd love to hear, please get in touch. You can contact me at ollie@wildedge.co, or you can find me on Instagram at ollie_France. So get in touch, shoot me a message. I'd love to hear your suggestions. And so, without further ado, here is my conversation with jet suit inventor, founder, and chief test pilot for Gravity Industries, Richard Browning. Hey, Richard Browning, a huge welcome to the Wild Edge podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Well, I believe you're just back from Florida.
Yeah, after not going to the US at all during COVID, I've now been 3 times in 4 weeks. The jet lag novelty is worn off for sure. But yeah, last week was Florida for the Edison Awards. Very flattering that we took away the gold award in our category for that, which is quite fun. And actually did a kind of evening reception and flight demo in the winter home, sort of estate area that Edison and Henry Ford, Thomas Edison and Henry Ford used to actually occupy in the winters. You know, they'd escape from the north of America down into the sunnier climes. So that was quite humbling to be flying in essentially their back gardens. That was quite fun. But it's been a busy few weeks.
Well, fantastic, and congratulations again on that. And that's now, but when I look back at your background, and I mean, naturally, you would suspect, and I'm sure you hear this a lot, that you would come from a fighter jet background or perhaps a stuntman, but that wasn't exactly the case. You worked as a oil trader for BP in the City of London. Could you tell us a little bit about that role? And I believe it did have some interesting aspects. I read you were out in Turkmenistan.
So I did end up specializing somewhat in the more unusual kind of geographies with that role. But yeah, essentially, I spent 16 years with BP, actually. I percolated towards the oil trading side of it and got involved in all sorts of interesting business in places like Mozambique and even Libya in Gaddafi's time and things like that. I mean, it was an amazing series of places to go and try and set up business with lots of challenges. Mm. But actually, in hindsight, the kind of skills and behaviors that you end up having to nurture running a commercial trading book actually really sort of look and feel quite similar to what I end up doing every day here now and running Gravity. And it's all around risk management. It's all around having an idea, often with nearly always imperfect information, assessing the downside potential of it and the upside, and then making a quick decision on whether you're going to progress that idea, and having a portfolio of those opportunities, and hoping that on balance the winners, which are usually less in number than the fails, outweigh in the medium term and long term those failures. And actually, whether it's a portfolio of innovative concepts and ideas or whether it's a trading book, actually the same kind of thing, really, in my mind.
I mean, the other thing that really stands out at during your time at BP is you were in the Royal Marine Reserve, so you're doing that. You know, you're away doing these cool things with the Royal Marines, I'm sure, and you're also doing ultra running. And I mean, thinking about the high octane nature of what you do now, and then placing you in that career in the City of London, were these things an escape from the office, the Royal Marines, and your ultra running?
Yeah, I think since I was in my sort of mid-teens, I suddenly sort of got into, more extreme sports, rock climbing, canoeing, running, and got into the military and things. I suppose they all represented an interesting place to go and sort of challenge and test yourself and push boundaries. But at the same time, they weren't impacting my family or me sort of financially, if that makes sense. So taking pain in an ultra run is kind of recoverable. You know that, eventually it'll go away, when you finish or you stop or whatever. It felt like a safe place to kind of push myself. I had a childhood learned inhibition around taking risk with, sort of the family security and financial security from experiencing, a lot of trauma on my dad's side. With a failed business venture. And so weirdly, the outlet then in hindsight was all these physical kind of pursuits, if you like. But the legacy relevant to what we do now with Gravity is actually that a huge part of the belief and motivation and confidence that came from those physical pursuits was weaved into the concept of trying to fly, but using your brain and your body rather than building just a flight vehicle you sit in. So actually, it contributed hugely to what we've gone on and done.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many people, and I speak to lots of explorers and adventurers pushing the limits, and there's often a familiar story where they're in a job that they just don't like, they're not passionate about, they're being dragged along this career. Was that the case for you? Was it an escape? Or was this some sort of burning passion inside you that you just needed to explore?
I've always been intrigued by things on the margin of what you or other people around you think can be done. So, you look at the ludicrous idea of running like a 50 or 100 mile ultramarathon, and as a normal, 5, 10, 15K kind of weekend runner, you think that just sounds mind-boggling. So I like it when you find those things and you think there's just an inkling chance you might be able to go and achieve it. And I've had the good fortune enough times in life, in my career and in my private life, that, I've had just enough of those weird self-challenges come good that I'm not put off pursuing those kind of things. And so, yeah, that was the case back in 2016 when I launched Gravity. I launched it in 2017, but when I kicked off the experiments that led to the flight system, it was just the latest in a long line of personal challenges that were unusual and probably not going to succeed. And you know, me personally, trying to get my green lid with the Royal Marines alongside my very busy day job was in that category, and I, you know, got there in the end. You know, running the ultramarathons, or I'd set up a couple of businesses before then, and they'd done all right. But you know, I guess I'm, you know, like lots of people, I just like a challenge. You know, it's what gets you out of bed in the morning to think, actually, I don't know if this is going to be possible to summit this mountain or not, but I'm sure as hell going to give it my all and dream about the day that when maybe I do, it'll be worth it all. That process, you know.
Yeah. I suppose to touch on it briefly, and this is often the thing that stops people from fulfilling their big goals, is the societal pressure aspect. And you're coming from, you know, what's a fairly conventional background in the city. Were there any raised eyebrows when you told people, you know, this crazy, ludicrous, bold scheme that you had?
Yeah, so I mitigated that by just not telling anybody for a long time. So, you know, I turned the concept into something that actually could fly, all in about 8 months and evenings and weekends and very late nights, and didn't tell anybody for exactly that reason. I mean, I was absolutely not confident it would ever work, and it sounded absolutely mad even if it did. And I had no business plan around it. I just thought it'd be an interesting challenge. So even when it was working, even when I had Red Bull and Wired magazine both lined up to do the launch video, and even when I received the invitation to do TED 2017 in Vancouver, I was really telling the bare minimum people necessary to get away with it. And very graciously, my employer allowed me an increasing amount of flexibility to go and kind of pursue this opportunity as I exited gradually from my former career. But yeah, I did it in a very conservative way where, you know, the last thing I enjoy doing is do a load of renders and a load of presentation stuff and then shout about what could be possible. I find that very personally risky because most of these things don't work out. And I just hate the idea that people think you're all talk and no trouser. I'd much prefer to properly fly the trousers around first and then talk about it where possible.
Yeah, it really is fascinating to look into your perception of risk in general. And, you know, people like you could often be called risk takers, but I suppose you're better classified as a risk mitigator, somebody who really understands risk.
Yeah, this whole subject of risk is fascinating, really, because to do anything new, anything that you or people around you or society or science or whatever thinks can't be done, you know, unfortunately, I run the odds at about 19 out of 20 times. They're all right, and you're the idiot. But you've got to survive those 19 failures that might all come in a row the sort of three rules that we follow, you know, and it's all about recoverable, survivable risk. And the crass way of describing it is what's the worst that could happen. It is all about it when failure occurs on that journey. Can you get back up again and look at it from a financial perspective? You know, it's stupid if you throw everything at your first idea and run out of money. You know, you're out of runway, right? Yeah. The next one is reputation. You only have one reputation. And if you start screwing around and upset the authorities or upset friends and family or your investors or, you know, anybody, you'll gradually find that you've got a diminishing circle of support. And investment in small businesses at the end of the day comes down to, you know, trust really and respect. And then the final one, the most important, is safety. You know, if you break both your legs on your first attempt at something, well, you know, it's going to be a long time before you're going to be able to have another go. And, you know, whilst what we do on the outside looks potentially very dangerous, actually, I'm just literally flying. I will post it up tonight, flying off the back of a quad bike for the first time, literally an hour ago, because we got an old quad bike and we were experimenting with it. And actually, we set it up in a way where if the worst happened and you fell, you know, had a failure and fell, you know, you're possibly going to clatter down onto this quad bike, possibly fall a few feet onto grass. You know, I used to cycle commute for 10 years of my career across London. And that's a very normal thing, and yet, frankly, far dangerous than what we do. So it's all about trying to manage that downside risk. And whilst, you know, you can't eliminate risk, there's always outlier things can happen. Actually, for 5 years, and for my team of 20, most of whom we fly, no one's even broken a single finger bone in what we do. And we'd like to try and keep it that way. And that's by managing risk. This is why you don't see us flying very high. We can fly as high as you like. Some people think it pushes off the ground. That's a big physics fail. Yeah. But we just don't do that because we try and manage the risk. That's all.
Yeah. I'd like to talk a little bit about the iterations of this innovation. You've talked about this fairly conservative approach where you're developing the product, you're testing, you're going away. And I mean, one particular image springs to mind, and that's you standing in a country road, blasting this thing at a hedgerow, you know, with the fuel in a mop bucket. And to compare that with the slick ergonomic product you have now, it's clearly there's been lots of iterations. So, I mean, could you talk about a couple of those early iterations and some of the things you learned?
Yeah, so yeah, the clip you're referring to, you can see that on the 2017 TED Talk or on our Gravity Industries YouTube. Yeah, that was doing the very first engine test with an engine on an arm. Obviously, we bench tested them loads beforehand. But that was one engine on the arm. And actually, that was a pivotal moment, really, because the learning was it's a very spongy, gentle push. There's no gyroscopic moment. There's no flailing around. It is just literally a proxy for you leaning on a surface. It was a big moment, really. Yeah. And just to be clear, yes, there was a container in the mop bucket. It didn't look like it.
Fair enough.
So actually, it was being very safe. It was actually a sort of bund around the container. But yes, I do joke. It looked like we had the fuel sloshing in a mop bucket. Yes, it has come on leaps and bounds. I mean, that was one engine. And then we went to two, then four, and then six. And I did the very first flight with a little engine on the back of each leg, as well as two on each arm. But now, yeah, the system, I mean, gosh, I did that Florida event was event, I think, 166 in 35 separate countries that despite COVID, we've managed to fly in. It all packs into two check-in suitcases. And, you know, there's always a chance, a bit like a spark plug failing on a car engine. There's always a chance that, you know, that they don't start up perfectly. But I mean, that's very rare. But, you know, you literally get the gear out, take about 20 minutes just to connect the arms to it, fuel it up, which you can run on diesel or jet fuel. So you can get diesel from a gas station if you want, then go flying, pack it up and go away again. It has got to the point where it is almost like, you know, I mean, the latest version starts up from cold in 15 seconds. So,
yeah,
you know, it's almost like grabbing your keys, starting your car and you can go. Now, it's not meant to be a practical thing that you go to the shops in, but in terms of its ability to then take you a couple of kilometers in any direction, it's got to a really quite sophisticated state. And yet the really exciting thing is, I sometimes feel a little bit like, you know, that, Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe story where, you know, having opened the wardrobe door to Narnia, I feel like a little bit we've opened the door into this world that all the sensible conventional aeronautics and engineering firms initially thought this was never going to be possible. Turns out it is. And now having proven that and patented it, there is just an endless sea of things that we can do to make it better. So we're never satisfied. Some people make the mistake of asking when we're finished. I mean, that's never the case. But yeah, it has got to a really sophisticated place now where, yeah, I'm very proud of it, really.
Yeah. I mean, you touched on these bigger entities, these bigger corporations. And I mean, when I look at Gravity Industries from the outside, I do see a lot of parallels with the Royal Marines, where, of course, you are a reservist there. You know, you've got a relatively small team. You've got a high degree of self-sufficiency. Do you think having that smaller, nimbler, self-sufficient approach has helped you with that innovation process, you know, in comparison to a larger, clunkier corporation?
Oh, massively. Yeah, it's a sad paradox that most of the world's resources are held by enormous corporations and enormous governments. And human beings are not designed to operate in teams more than about, God, I don't know, pick your number, around 100, 80 to 120. That's the kind of largest operational field command in a military unit. Surprise really in that. It is immensely hard as soon as you don't know the individuals concerned and you don't know what they're good at and what their strengths and weaknesses are and can't judge their morale and their motivation and you can't fill in the gaps where something's lacking. As soon as you lose that and it becomes a PowerPoint handed down management hierarchies, I mean, it's just, as we all know, very few of us have not had that experience. And most people probably listening to this are probably still in that experience. We as humanity have got to get better and better at trying to erode that, because the speed with which my 20 person team can react, it is a bit like a little special forces team in that sense. Yeah. It's the opposite to a, you know, 5,000 conscripts all just waiting for a, you know, hand me down message from a pigeon or something. It is amazing. I mean, I suppose in a way I've been from an 80,000 person organization in BP to now a 20 person organization. And yes, the nimbleness, efficiency, speed of learning, speed of evolution. I mean, even just this week, since I've been back from Florida, we've just accelerated so many elements of what we do. I mean, just literally, you kindly allowed me to start slightly later because we were prolonging our testing. I mean, we're in the Lake District next week doing another round of paramedic testing. So we've just built up some suits for actually a paramedic to use for the first time in there. So that's all tested. I've tested what I'm going to be flying. I've tested a new shoulder support system, which just makes flying in long distances a bit more comfortable. Yeah. I've tested a new chase drone. We've tested a new mobile fueling system. And we've tested taking off and landing from a moving quad bike for no particular reason other than we thought we could, and it turns out you can. I mean, all of that in an hour. It is ridiculous what you can do when you're properly set up.
Yeah, it's incredible. And what I really love, you know, when you follow your YouTube stuff, is that you do take the viewer through this iterative process. You show all of these wings that you've tried, all the different arrangements. And I suppose a big part of that is having the on-site facilities, as you do, to print. And I know you do lots of 3D printing yourself. Does that help with your nimble approach?
Yeah, I mean, we have a couple of machines ourselves, but they're just the FDM machines, you know, squeezing toothpaste out in a tube and coiling it up, that kind of thing, which are amazing, to be fair, but they're not structurally what we really need. So we then send away the design to a big sort of multinational company that does SLS printing, so lasering multiple layers of powder into a huge structure. Mm. So the entire seats now are printed in polypropylene. They're kind of slightly car tire-y and rubbery, which is great. And the lovely thing is there is no mold involved. So as soon as it arrives, within seconds, we're often going, why don't we just tweak this, that, and the other? And certainly when you go and fly it, you immediately have lots of thoughts of how you can improve it. Well, that evening, my CAD designer can make those changes and we can submit it again for printing. Mm. You know, so each iteration, I mean, we don't quite that crazy because each iteration is about £5,000, but, you know, within a week, we probably have submitted it again, and we can just advance. So yeah, additive 3D printing, is an enormous enabler to relentless improvement and enhancement. You know, it fills me with horror, the idea that you spend £100,000 on a mold. Mm. And each item is very cheap. But I mean, yeah, after injecting a couple of them, we'd be then thinking we want to change it again.
And do you think that, you know, that need to constantly iterate and constantly improve, do you think you'll ever reach a point where you think, okay, I'm happy, this is the finished product? Or are you not quite there yet? I mean, how do you see that playing out?
I mean, designers, engineers, creatives, you know, they're never finished. As soon as you've done the latest thing, you're always spotting how you can improve it. We have in the past, and we'll have to do it again soon. We have to kind of pause on a design, and then we can produce several of them for, you know, a particular military or medic or, you know, other purpose. But behind that, just like cars, I mean, you know, the designers have to be held back and pause and produce a model that has to be marketed and sold and produced in large numbers. But, you know, as sure as hell as that's starting to come off the production line, they're already working on the next one. So yeah, that will continue with us very much.
For anyone who's not seen it, I do urge them to go and have a look at your jet suit. It is simply incredible. And one of the things I love is the joy it brings to all of the spectators. And I'm sure that's something you're very familiar with. Has this played a part in you developing the race series, which I believe is something you're working on?
Yeah, it's funny that. So the best way I can describe it for people who haven't seen it live, I mean, seeing it online and stuff is kind of cool. It almost looks fake. It just looks almost effortless. Mm. And I mean, you know, we'd done an amazing job if we'd faked this all over those countries I've mentioned. But it does look so easy and so smooth that it does look fake. The great thing is when you see it live, it looks even more fake. So your brain that's used to just simplifying things around you, unless you've, you know, got a, you know, the challenge of autism with the way that process struggles, you can't simplify this in your brain. So your brain literally freezes for a moment. This is the experience of doing this to probably millions of people around the world now.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. I mean, in pre-COVID, and I only say this for reasons that will become obvious in a second, pre-COVID, you'd have people come up and hug you after events because with tears in their eyes, because they would be so overwhelmed by the visual of seeing that ancient human desire to rise up and move around like the birds, the thing we can never do naturally. We have to build machines that we're strapped to or sit on or inside. And it was amazing. It was quite a profound thing. I mean, I'm not just talking about kids. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, retired folks who would just literally lose their minds with what they were seeing. So when it came to then, how do you go and scale that effect? Well, back in 2020, we had everything lined up to go and launch the inaugural race series in Bermuda. We'd done some events out in Bermuda, and there's a small community that really wanted us out there in the harbor there. And if you imagine like Red Bull Air Race, you know, sweeping around inflatable pylons in the harbor area, except this time it's in a smaller, more visible format, and you've got real human beings that look like superheroes dashing around doing explosive launches off, you know, jetties and hammering around these pylons, and every now and then somebody going in the water and it obviously floats. We have thought about that. Then that was all ready to go, and then 3 weeks away from us being out there, we had to pause it because of COVID. And to be honest, we've had some of our best years commercially, despite all that hassle, because we've just again adapted and you know adjusted the business model. But the race series will happen. We haven't got any immediate plans at the moment. My real desire is that it actually becomes a natural gathering of military, so you know, special forces folks, paramedics, and our clients who have learned with us.
Yeah.
And a bit like how NASCAR grew up accidentally because it was bootlegging hot rodders, testing out their gear to see how they can outrun the police.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting we have the same illegality to our origins, but in terms of the authenticity, I very much want that rather than we're just doing it because a big sponsor has chucked some money in. I want it to be happening and people hear about it on the grapevine and come and watch, and it grows like that. So, you know, as we shed the last of the COVID shackles, you know, and people get used to going out to live events and stuff, and as the demand from those three sectors grows, then that's how I envisage it happening. And it is the most ludicrous fun to hammer around and chase after each other. It is just mind-blowingly fun. If you think flying this is fun, chasing each other in three-dimensional space like that is out of this world.
Incredible. Well, I do hope it comes off, and I'll certainly be keeping an eye out for it. I know, as you mentioned, you've done lots of big events all across the world, you know, dozens of countries. Are there any particularly bizarre requests that you've had?
Yeah, I mean, we try and tread a line where, you know, we've got 3 million followers on TikTok, for goodness sake, and there's like a couple of some posts on there. The biggest one, I think, is 72 million views. You know, and we're quite good at doing very short little posts that are quite fun and engaging, often very human, like, you know, grabbing a, you know, grenade protein bar off somebody and flying away again. I mean, that's the 70 million one. Just recently, I hovered and managed to suck through a tiny little 6 mil. It was a fuel line that wasn't used as a fuel line. I managed to drink some grenade energy drink out of a tiny, you know, out of the ring pool hole of a can whilst hovering. I mean, and it's kind of, you know, it's playful and slightly silly, but actually, if you know, my good friend, the former First Sea Lord, now Chief of the Defence Staff, saw that, with whom we're engaged on various different bits of work, you know, is it embarrassing or dangerous or stupid? Well, no, it's playful. And actually, if you look at it, another demonstration of how ridiculously stable and controlled this is. So we try and not do anything that would embarrass any of the very serious organisations we work with. Yeah. But at the same time, have a huge amount of fun and do stuff that, you know, the kids would like. So, but one we didn't say yes to was, I think there's some Japanese thing where I had to dress up as a sushi robot. I was going to get one of my team to do this and fly in and land and then serve sushi in some way. We never got into the detail because the whole thing sounded ridiculous, but I can't say it didn't sound quite amusing to try and disguise a jet suit inside this sushi robot and then fly in. But yeah, that was probably a weird one we didn't do. I'm trying to think now. I mean, out of, like I say, over 160 odd events, we have done some pretty unusual things. I think one that was weird that was actually pretty cool was Adam Savage, who's a good friend, got printed in titanium, the Iron Man suit using the CAD files from Marvel.
Right.
And we taught Adam to fly for a couple of days, and he did really well, actually, and then gave me the challenge of flying that suit, and I flew it with the eyepieces in as well. So I couldn't really even see out apart from out of a corner of one of them. You can see that on various social media things, but we did actually fly the real Iron Man suit. It was stupidly heavy and very clunky, but yeah, all sorts of things, really.
When you, I mean, this is probably a question that you get a heck of a lot. I mean, do you ever see a future? I just have to ask where the jetpack is used as for mass human transport.
I mean, at the moment, it would be like taking a Formula One car to the shops, you know. I mean, I could put it on now. They're literally all around me, still fueled up. I could fly down to my local shop, land, walk in the shop, wearing it while it's cooling, buy some stuff, start back up and fly back again. I could even stop in theory at a, you know, gas station and fill it up with diesel if we just produce the right nozzle. But, I mean, it doesn't pass my, you know, reputation lens. You know, I'm going to shock and upset some people who maybe weren't expecting that, like everybody that wasn't expecting that. You know, it's pretty noisy. I mean, it's like an air show in terms of noise level. And it's just not a practical kind of thing. And if everybody was doing that, it would be insane. So, you know, the analogy, like a Formula One car, you could go to the shops in a Formula One car, but no one does because it's stupid. So, but then again, the first motor cars were considered noisy, smelly, and crazy compared to a horse. So, if I say that, you know, we built our first electric one and that's gone from 10 seconds to 30 seconds, we took it out to prevent an event with Bezos, actually. He specifically asked to see it, and we did some 10 seconds flights for him. That was the first of the three US trips about a month ago. But since bringing it back, we've actually enhanced it now to 30 seconds. So, you know, maybe a colder, quieter electric version that sort of pings the ground and make sure you don't fly too high and, you know, has some, I don't know, some other protective things in it, then maybe.
Yeah.
So I'd be a fraud to my own kind of philosophy if I said never, but it's not the purpose of it at the moment.
Clearly, you're an incredible innovator. Do you ever think about other products that you could develop? Do you need to fight to keep focused on the jet suit?
Yeah, there's a bunch of actually other things. We've got a few other things we're working on and a few other things I'd love to be working on if I had the time. Because there is so much demand and so many avenues that we've got progressing. I mean, you know, crazily enough, we haven't raised money since that very first accidental raise in 2017, just before TED. You know, and we're a profitable company. We've got no debt, don't need to do a raise, and got lots of money coming in and lots in the bank. I mean, how crazy for a company that does what we do, right? But that's only come about because we focused on it and we don't just, you know, lose focus and wander off and do something else. But yeah, I especially as we mature some of the military and medic applications, my vision is that we can hand the reins over for those to other people who can do, you know, frankly, the more process focused embedment of a productionized product. I mean, that's a long phrase for you. I'm not very good or excited about that stuff. I would like to be focusing more on the journeys that I'm good at, which is the probably never going to work, but let's try it anyway stuff.
Yeah. I wonder if, you know, you spend a lot of time flying. You're the chief flight tester for the jet suit. And that, of course, means pushing it to its limits. I wonder if there's ever been a moment where you felt like, okay, I've pushed things a little too far here. That was a bit reckless or a bit dangerous.
I mean, you get moments of that. I mean, you know, talk to a racing driver and there'll be moments where they're not proud of, where it's gone, you know, they've gone beyond where they were comfortable or where it's sensible. The big area for us was the wing testing stuff. So trying to put a base jumper kind of leg wing on, spread your legs and you create, you know, a lot of lift, and then you flatten out and accelerate like crazy and the rear engine just thunders you along like a little rocket. That was pretty cool. I mean, we set the Guinness World Record at 85 miles an hour doing that. And I had to learn in real time how to transition, a bit like a Harrier or an F-35. There is a transition from vectored thrust flight, blowing air downwards to lift up, to transitioning to being a fighter flying forwards using aerodynamic control. I had to sort of learn the aerodynamic control thing very crudely and much clearly slower speeds. But in real time, that was exciting. And things like deciding how to get elevator control that you have on the back end of a plane and realizing that if you drop your legs, I thought that would potentially pitch me forward and down, but it didn't. Mm. It acted like an elevator and I just climbed like crazy. And I was going down the lake that we use for testing not far from here. And I remember seeing the tops of the 100-foot trees drop below me, either side of me, and thought, yeah, you know, a little red light comes on in your head and you think, yep, I now need to resolve this current predicament. Panic appears and you look at it and think, you are really not helpful. So go away. And then you just calmly work out how to, you know, remove yourself out of that envelope that has become potentially dangerous. So, you know, it's, the good thing about what we do, unlike, I would say, skydiving or parachuting or scuba diving, how we are operating most of the time, you're operating at a speed and a height and over a surface where it could potentially not hurt, hurt quite a lot, but it's not going to do any permanent damage. Every now and then there are fleeting moments where you think, shit, if I got a failure right now, this could really hurt a lot. But luckily they are fleeting moments. So you have to have a real unfortunate confluence of events to see a failure occur in that brief fleeting moment. You know, scuba diving, you need everything to work really well all the time. or you're in an unsustainable scenario, or you have to start relying on a lot of backups very quickly. So you know, I'm not dishing scuba diving too much. Millions of people do it all every day, all around the world, but we are not in a life-threatening situation for most of what we do, and therefore that helps. But yes, there's been plenty of occasions where it's been interesting.
It seems like, as you've described, it's something that really needs to be seen properly to be believed, or even for those who can to try it. Could you talk about any events coming up this year in the UK that people could come and see the jet suits? And indeed, if people really want to have a go, is that a possibility with you?
Yeah, so for the last 3 or 4 years, we've actually run a flight training and flight experience center at Goodwood, the home of the Festival of Speed. It's on the edge of the Spitfire runway and surrounded by the former Formula One track there at the Goodwood Festival, you know, Goodwood Estate. So yeah, if you go to the gravity.co website, you can sign up to a flight experience, which is the cheaper experience versus the full day flight training, neither of which are very, very cheap, I have to say, unfortunately. We are trying to broaden that out, but it has to compete with all the other things that we get asked to do. and they all distract from our R&D journey. So that we're setting up, we belatedly setting up a couple of those in the US as well soon, which is going to be very exciting. Yeah. But yeah, to watch it, gosh, I very fortunately rely on a very good PA who runs my entire diary, to the extent that when I was in Nevada doing some sneaky stuff with the US military, I didn't even know that the Edison Awards were the next week until I got home and she told me that I need to get back on the plane again in a few days' time to go to Florida for that event. I just literally have to focus so much on what the event is that's staring me down that she then organizes with my rest of my team and what I'm doing the days after that. So in terms of other UK events, I don't know, to be honest. The best thing to do is keep an eye on our social media. I mean, it's Take on Gravity on Instagram, and we had to change the TikTok one. It's now Richard M. Browning. But and Gravity Industries on YouTube. We've done a terrible job of trying to keep some consistency across that lot. Yeah, there should be some events happening in the UK. I mean, we've done things like the Tall Ships event in I think it was up in Worcester. Was it Worcester? I can't remember now. Before COVID, we did loads of different UK events. We've done the Farnborough Air Show, the Bournemouth Air Show, all sorts of things. Frankly, it's very hard to navigate UK events in the carnage that is left after COVID. But yeah, there should be some opportunities coming up, hopefully.
Oh, fantastic. It really is an incredible development that you've made. And the jet suit itself, it's just so visual and visceral. I'm not surprised. You know, it's a marketeer's dream, really. But the final question, really, it comes down to you and the machine. And if we strip away for a moment the events and the obstacles and the stunts and everything, when it's you zooming along in the jet suit, what's going through your mind? Do you enter an almost flow state?
So that's a good question. So the boring answer is a bit like, again, I've done some very amateur hill climbing in a car, but I'm guessing at the motor racing analogy here. I'm guessing if you ask a Formula One driver, you know, are you having a mind dazzling, really fun time hammering around that track? You know, I think their answer usually would be they are so focused on doing the job, trying to get the outcome they want and trying to do it safely, that they're not just, you know, having a Homer Simpson little fairground ride going on in their head. My answer would be the same. Nearly every big flight we do, and the same will be in the Lake District next week, and there's going to be some chunky ones. You know, you're focused on just doing what you need to do. Now, having said that, I did have a brain scan thing glued to my head at one point for an interesting little exercise. And the moment I took off, all the background noise that you get normally just going on in your head that everybody has, that actually almost flatlined and was described by the people doing the analysis as a flow state reaction. But I'm not like in some sort of meditative, you can't talk to me. I could happily chat away to you. I mean, we play with various radio systems where you can do that over the noise. Yeah. I'm concentrating as much as I am running or cycling. And yet actually in both those instances, your brain is doing an awful lot of balance and predictive sort of analytics to keep you stable. The great thing about how we fly is it's actually way more stable than either of those activities. You're a wigwam of thrust vectors. If you look at a heat signature thing we did posted a few weeks back, that was from the Bezos event, actually, you can see that visually, and that's why it's so stable. So I do allow myself to, especially over water, where, you know, if you get a problem, you're just going to fall in the water. It's not the end of the world. I do try and step back and just acknowledge that it is a ridiculous view and a ridiculous sensation. And you are as free as you are in that dream that you sometimes have of flying, where you sort of run, sort of walk, run, and then step off and just float wherever you want. It is like that. But yeah, the boring answer is there's usually a lot of things you have to go and deliver, like opening the entire Japanese baseball season in 2018 or whatever it was. You know, all you're thinking about live on TV to the nation is, I really hope everything works like it should do. You know, fun doesn't really figure until afterwards if it's worked well, which it did in that case.
And so all these years on, your passion for this project still runs just as deep.
I mean, I delight in applying it to different challenging circumstances. That's why I'm jovially sort of referred to as the founder and chief test pilot. I still put myself up for, you know, well, things like flying off a quad bike, like earlier today. I mean, I delight in what you can achieve with this marriage of horsepower with the human mind and body. It is quite ridiculous. And frankly, 95% of the credit should just go to the human body and not just mine. I'm the least athletic of my team, really. It is amazing what you can train a human mind and body to do. Look at around us, you know, all these billions of people, all the different jobs and skills and athletic feats that they can apply themselves to. It is phenomenal. really.
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely incredible. It's really interesting to get an insight into your mind and hear a lot more about the jet suit. Very, very grateful for your time today, Richard. It's been brilliant to meet you. Really appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing what the future holds for yourself and Gravity Industries.
My pleasure. Yeah, been great to talk.
Well, there we have it, Richard Browning. What a fascinating, innovative, imaginative, extraordinary mind. A real, real privilege to sit down with Richard and hear his story, hear all about Gravity Industries. And I really am excited to see what the future holds for them. Next week, we have a very similar guest. In some ways, he's also a former Royal Marine. He also likes to fly through the air, but not via jet suit. My next guest is Tim Howell. He is one of the world's foremost base jumpers, wingsuit pilots. He lives an extraordinary high octane life of adventure and adrenaline, and his story is remarkable. He holds countless world firsts, and he has a really interesting relationship and perspective on fear, on risk, on societal pressure, which I feel can be applied to so many different areas of all of our lives. To make sure you don't miss this episode and you do not want to miss this next episode, do make sure you hit subscribe. These episodes are released every week on Tuesday mornings, and you can be the very first to hear it. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Wild Edge podcast with me, Ollie France. Have a good day. Hey, why not plan your own adventure? Something big, something bold. Let me know about it. I'd love to know what you're up to. Have a good one.